Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Deep pockets, snooker, and the meaning of life. The game of snooker has a remarkable history from its humble origins. It's blossomed spectacularly in the 80s to the nation's most popular sports. Top players become celebrities. The papers were stuffed with snooker scandals, even conquered the pop charts. 21st century, the game is still big news. But strangely, perhaps, snooker's deeper meanings have never really been properly explored. Well, they have now, because it's the new book, Deep Pockets, delves into the meaning of snooker. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, author of Deep Pockets, Brendan Cooper. Brendan, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure is mine. We tend to think of snooker as Steve Interesting Davis and Terry Griffiths and Ronnie O'Sullivan. And it seems quite a sort of very financially rewarding pastime for those who've made it a profession. But there's a deeper meaning to snooker then.
Is and that's quite interesting that you reference these great figures, Davis, O'Sullivan, and so forth. I think a lot of the writing on snooker over the years has tended to focus on some of the great personalities of the game, unsurprisingly perhaps. But one of the things it's meant is that there has been not very much written, I think, a sort of serious-minded examinations and studies of the history and the culture of snooker. Certainly not very much since the 1980s. It's been quite poorly served, I think, in that respect, in comparison to pretty much every other sport. So one of the things I was trying to do in this book was to remedy that, was to write about snooker and write about the history of the game and some of the great matches and great characters across that history, but also to connect snooker in various ways to the world of ideas.
Because if you think about it, the group, and I've had the pleasure of interviewing Barry Hearn on a couple of occasions, and he talks about how, you know, he took snooker and was instrumental in taking it in the 80s from what up to then had been a sort of a late night BBC Two, kids ask your parents, a late night BBC Two sort of niche into something that in the 80s, I mean, I interviewed, name's gone completely from my mind now, but, a young Scottish guy who was the heart from
Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen. Right. Thank you. There you go. Completely blank. My sister was an absolute groupie of Stephen, you know, as a teenage girl. She thought he was the best thing since bread was sliced. And snooker became massive in the 80s and the 90s, and the nation was glued. And now it's gone global in a way with China, with Thailand, etc., in a way, and exhibition matches that you would never have thought, you know, watching Ray Reardon in the 70s.
Yeah, and that, the transformation of snooker from a game, you know, played in sort of the working men's clubs and industrial towns in Britain, but a game that didn't really have a big popular profile. The transformation of that into what happened in the sort of 70s into the 80s is pretty extraordinary and unique, I think, in British cultural history. And colour television, of course, was the main reason for that, the main mechanism, because it was David Attenborough, of all people, as the controller of BBC Two, who commissioned Pot Black in 1969. It became very popular, and then I think the public realised that this was a kind of perfect televisual spectacle. You know, half an hour of these figures who, to begin with, people hadn't heard of. But then, you know, as the years went on, they became household names. And as you say, by the time we got to the 1980s, snooker, I think people often struggle to believe that this is true, but snooker genuinely was the most popular sport in Britain in the 1980s. Steve Davis was comfortably in the middle of the 1980s, comfortably the highest earning sports person in Britain. And there was something about that that's really interesting, something about the fact that it was being beamed into people's living rooms, being sort of watched by British people with their sort of, you know, their cups of tea and slices of toast, the kind of coziness, the living room coziness that is an important element of British kind of indoor culture, I think, kind of is one of the reasons why snooker caught fire. But as you say, it also remains popular to a degree that I think some people underestimate. And it's popular in Britain still. 4.5 million people watched the world final last year. That made it the highest rating show. It was watched by more people than Coronation Street and EastEnders. So it's still really big in the UK, but it also has a level of international profile. It's always had an element of the international within it, but now the international expansion of snooker has been in the last sort of decade or two really dramatic, not just in China, but in the Middle East, in other parts of Southeast Asia, and in Europe as well. And so snooker is, the tentacles of snooker across the world continue to grow.
And also the thing is, it's, you know, and I'm not going to get too esoteric on you here, but it's the pace of the game. For the same reason that, you know, a five-setter at Wimbledon, although an awful lot more exertion, you could argue, goes out on centre court, but it's the way that a snooker match will build and take a period of time. It's not, you know, a five-minute blip. And so in this, you know, so when something goes, and I'm going to bring up the ghost of Jimmy White here, because when something goes wrong, then it grips the nation like a Greek tragedy, because it just unfolds like a, you know, with the brutality of a Game of Thrones episode.
Yeah, I actually think that's a really important point about snooker and what makes it compelling. It is a slow game, and there are a couple of about the slowness of snooker that make it precious for that reason. And one of them, I think, is that it creates this quality to the game whereby it's simultaneously kind of a calm and relaxing phenomenon to be watching, and then it's also a compelling and dramatic thing to be watching. And as you mentioned, the matches last for several hours. When you get to the World Championship, matches last for 2 or even 3 days. And one of the things that does is that, you know, the moments of dramatic tension, if a match goes close, if we're in a deciding frame, if there's a kind of key ball that gets missed right at the end of the match, the particular kind of drama around that moment is dependent on the fact that it's taken, you know, all this time to get there, this sort of quiet, incremental build-up of other sort of less significant moments from frame towards the end. I think that is something that, you know, snooker has a particular kind of combination, I feel, of slowness and compelling drama that you don't quite find in the same way everywhere else. And that also, I think, kind of makes it sit uneasily with elements of contemporary culture, with the fact that things so often tend to be very fast-paced, that we expect to access information instantly all the time. And then we have this game that's beamed into people's homes, where things are quiet and slow and take a long time to kind of build towards a conclusion. And there's something about that I think is really valuable, and I think is to do with is written that continuing popularity of the game. I think that we do have within us an appetite for longer, more epic narratives, and I think that snooker can satisfy that.
And also, snooker and the rise of the anti-hero, if you like, because if you look, it you know, we have the clean-cut players, we have the Stephen Henrys, we have the Terry Griffiths, you know, that lovely story. But then there is, if you go back to some of the original characters, I mean, you look at people like Bill Werbenick or Cliff Thorburn or Alex Higgins, for example. I mean, these were people who, I mean, if you look at some of the 70s stuff, that would never be allowed now in a professional era. But, you know, they were geniuses, but they were flawed geniuses, and that is attractive, and that is compelling as well.
Yeah, and that's something else that I talk about in the book. Second chapter is called Disorder. And there is in snooker a long history of just what you might call self-destructive behavior of various kinds. That's, you know, heavy drinking, drugs, and just kind of a lifestyle that you wouldn't generally associate with top-level sporting performance. But with snooker, of course, one of the things about the game is that you don't have to be in magnificent athletic shape in order to win a snooker match. And that, I think, is connected in perhaps important ways to the fact you've had figures like Alex Higgins, Jimmy White, and most notoriously, perhaps Bill Werbenuk. You had to have something like 8 to 10 pints of lager before he would start a match in order to correct the arm tremor that he suffered from. So the stories are quite outlandish and pretty extraordinary. It gives this incredible kind of color to the cultural history of the game. Inevitably, in more recent years, these sorts of outlandish stories have become fewer and further between as the standards of professionalism have intensified. Although you still do certainly get stories of disorder and dissolution in snooker as well. Mm. So that's absolutely true. These stories are you know, some of them are pretty difficult to credit. But they did happen, they're part of the cultural history of the sport.
And with any sport, I suppose, it teaches us, you know, competition and luck and how to deal with loss. And I mean, I'm not saying, you know, are we talking, Brendan, the Tower of Snooker? I mean, if snooker had come from, I mean, perhaps it does, perhaps I'm wrong on this. Perhaps there is, the first snooker was played in China by mandarins or something. But I mean, if it'd come from like with a Zen backing, people would say the green base represents, and the black and the white and the colors represent the various stages. I mean, I'm getting very esoteric on you here. The various stages of life, and it teaches us lessons that we should be able to carry on, apart from having 8 pints, obviously, to steady your arm tremor.
Well, I mean, I do talk in the book about this possible symbolic significance of the different colours on snooker table. No, I mean, snooker originated, well, it was birthed in the clubhouses of the Victorian Raj, in fact. Officers playing around the billiards table. It's a variant, essentially, of billiards, which was a game that you can trace back 400 or 500 years, at least, in Northern Europe, but a game that was evolving in France and England in the 15th century, certainly by then. So you mentioned the psychological pressures of the game, and those, I think, it's another unique quality that the game has. Obviously, in all high-level sport, the psychological pressure is intense. But there's a particular kind of helplessness to the snooker player who's stuck in his chair, able to do nothing as he's watching his opponent clear up. And sometimes, you know, as any snooker fan listening will know, that, you know, a professional can break off and then just watch their opponent make a century break and that's it. They don't actually get a chance themselves. And so there is something really uniquely intense about the psychological pressure and difficulty and fragility of the snooker player that perhaps can be linked to the fact that we find the mental pressures of snooker affecting players in quite serious ways at times. And mental health, thankfully, in recent years has become something that has for snooker players become a more publicly accessible phenomenon. And you know, Mark Selby, a couple of years ago, there was a lot of attention to the fact that he's one of the all-time greats of the game, and he was struggling with his game and actually tweeted about his mental health, and he was really struggling, and then he got a lot of immediate support was really encouraging. And I think that that's something else, what you might describe perhaps as a darker edge, a darker element to the game, whereby, you know, snooker it is a game where you sit and think, and, you know, the psychological kind of pressure of it and the psychological helplessness of it as you're watching an opponent defeat you is something that exists in snooker in unique ways. And so there are also, as well as the kind of the sort of wonderful sort of nostalgic memories that people have about the game, is also a ruthless and brutal sport in all sorts of different ways.
And you are, I mean, we talk about boxers, entirely different sort of discipline, obviously, or tennis players. If it goes wrong, you are there for the world to see. There's no hiding place, and there's no hiding place for a snooker player in those hushed, elegant surrounds, is there, when it all goes wrong? Or there's, you know, a golfer on the 18th needing that pot for, you know, that putt for victory, and it goes back, yeah. But he's got a crowd behind him, he's got a team, he's got a caddy, the whole thing. Snooker players, I mean, they've got, you know, managers, and maybe they've got somebody who travels with them, but otherwise, I mean, the life of a professional snooker player, hotel to hotel room, on the circuit, you don't have teammates, you know, you are almost like a tennis player, but you don't have that, the backup of trainers and knock-up partners and whatever else. I mean, it's a very strange way, I suppose, to live a life.
Yeah, that is true, and I think that in order to become a successful snooker player, one of the things that is obviously required is a kind of obsessive commitment to the game from a very early age, you know, almost to be doing nothing else. And there are countless stories of players, you know, sacrificing their education, sacrificing everything else in order to become professional, in order to make it. And there's a point there. There's a class-based point, you know, that snooker as a working class game, but also snooker as a game that doesn't have the infrastructure surrounding it that allows the sorts of narrative that you find, say, for a lot of cricket professionals, a lot of rugby professionals who have no problem completing their school education, heading to university, getting a degree, and then becoming professional after that. A snooker player, you know, by the time they're 21, that's too late for a snooker player. They have to do it earlier. And so everything has to go. That's, you know, you read Stephen Hendry, he talks about exactly that. You read Steve Davis, he talks about exactly that. Peter Ebdon, the 2002 world champion, he talks about the same thing and says that he was actually really quite academic in school, but he had to just, you know, say to his parents, no, this is it. Everything else is going to go. And so it is an absolute commitment, and a commitment to a lifestyle where, you know, there are particular forms of isolation to it, I think, that you perhaps don't find in many other sports. And you mentioned golf, you know, another individual sport, but, you know, playing a game of snooker is a bit like playing a round of golf, but there's someone else hitting your ball off course, you know, every second shot, you know. And so that, again, there is that lack of absolute control over your destiny, which is part of the reason why I think in many ways it's the most psychologically ruthless sport in the world. And that's obviously quite a big claim, but I think in particular, for particular reasons, I would suggest that there's a reason to think that.
And isn't it fascinating though that a game that springs, had its roots from the officer class of India, should be embraced by the working class in the UK? We think of those smoky snooker rooms where all the present thing comes from. And it's, you know, it's predominantly now a working class game. And doesn't that say something very, very interesting as well? And it gives, somewhat like boxing does, a route out of perhaps a more humdrum existence.
Yeah, it does. I mean, there are so many stories. I mean, the story of Jimmy White is a really interesting one, and quite a famous one to snooker fans, the way in which he, you know, his local snooker hall called Zan's, you know, he would head there as a young kid, and initially would head there because it was just a place to go, you know, and he would he'd light the atmosphere of the place. It was a while before he actually started playing snooker there. And then, of course, you know, he'd be skipping school to play snooker, and actually had this extraordinary arrangement with the headmaster of his school whereby they agreed that if he could be in school in the mornings, then he would be able to be absent from school in the afternoon in order to go and play snooker. And so there are, and there, that's a particularly well-known story, but there are lots of stories like that that I think are indicative of the culture that you describe.
So when was the starting point, and who did you speak to, or is this on your, as your own personal reference and your own personal observations?
In terms of researching the book?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, a lot of it is my own individual reading and research into the history of the game and the players and watching a lot of the old matches and just trying to put together a tapestry of thinking about how these different, you know, great players and great matches and elements of the history of the game, how these might be thought about in new ways. And so, for example, there's an early chapter in the book on victory. And so I talk there about some of the great winners in snooker history. I talk about Steve Davis in the 80s and the way he dominated that decade. And then Stephen Hendry in the 90s and how he did the same, only more so, really, in the decade that followed. But I'm also trying to look at them in relation to this concept of victory and this notion of what a winning mentality is and where it comes from. I think there are some very interesting things about Davis and Hendry in their personalities, what you might describe as sort of oddities and eccentricities of personality that are really unusual. It's really unusual to be as ruthless, as brutally determined to win as they were. So I try to, so as I'm sort of looking back at the sort of the characters and the history of snooker, I'm trying in each chapter to think conceptually about what that might tell us about, in that case, about victory. And the chapter that follows that inevitably is about loss. And I look at the tragic, the very, very successful, but also tragic sort of career of Jimmy Ride, in the sense that he lost all of those world finals. And thinking about what that means, and also why it is that the losers tend to be the players that we are fondest of, and that perhaps that tells us something about loss. It tells us something about ourselves, and the way that we actually identify better with losing in life. And these ruthless winners are kind of more alien presences that are harder for us to understand.
Fascinating. The book is called Deep Pockets, Snooker and the Meaning of Life. You will never look at the snooker game ever in the same way again. Brendan, if people want to find you online, do you have a social media presence? Do you have a website? Where can people find you?
Yeah, I Twitter will be the best answer to that. BCooper147, I'm on Twitter, and so very happy to be in touch with anyone about snooker at all times.
The book is called Deep Pockets, Snooker and the Meaning of Life. Brendan, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.